Well, good evening, everybody. It's wonderful to see so many people here. I've attended so many lectures on globalisation here, in which I was the only person in the audience. In fact, I've given one or two of those lectures myself, so it's great to have so many people here. Tonight, well, we're here for a balloon debate. I suppose, in a way, we're here to test whether or not the custodians of human rights also have a sense of humour as well. But we are principally here for a balloon debate, which is concerned with who do you think is the greatest human rights personality of modern times. I'm just going to be a little tiny bit pedantic and explain the nature of this debate, because I'm slightly aware that the notion of debate seems to have slightly disappeared these days. Indeed, I was recently in a debate in which I was arguing for the end of marriage, and someone stood up and said, how can you possibly argue that marriage is all over when you yourself have been married three times? And I said, it's a bleeding debate, for God's sake. But that didn't seem to satisfy. There's something about the nature of contemporary individuality which makes it difficult for people to embrace and pretend to an opinion they don't actually hold. Anyway, the concept of the balloon debate. The idea is that we have, as I say, I'm being pedantic, the idea is that you have six people. Six people are in a balloon. Well, technically, they're in the basket under the balloon. Or more technically still, in what is called the gondola. The gondola constructed from wicker and light wood. There are six passengers in here. The six passengers in here are Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, George Orwell, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Joseph Stalin. But the balloon is sinking. Gravity is exerting its force, and there's not enough heated air in the envelope of the balloon to keep all six airborne. So therefore, five of them have to go, and only one person has to remain. And of course, that person who remains and stays alive is the person who you think is most likely to contribute to human rights development and advancement in the future, so, or may have done so in the past indeed. So it's very exciting, really very, very exciting. And what we're going to do, the rules are this, that each speaker who will speak in either the first person or the third person. So some people will become the human rights campaigners they are representing. Not down to costume, you understand, but nevertheless they will be speaking with a personal pronoun. Each speaker has 8 minutes, and after each speaker I will take two questions from the audience, which must be addressed to the personality to say, for example, why should you, Gandhi, stay within the balloon because of this and this? If you want to make a statement, then try to rephrase it into an interrogative form and I'll allow it. But no bold statements. And after that, after everyone has spoken, we'll take a vote. And we'll reduce it to the last two. Two people will be left in. The other four will leave the stage ignominiously. The other four will leave the stage, and the two remaining people will then have 3 minutes each to further argue their case, and then we will take a final vote. Does that seem clear? That aren't any new rules here. You haven't heard before, have you? I don't know what this flock is like. I only just met a few of them for the first time. Whether they'll behave themselves or not, I don't know. I'm going to be brutal over the 8-minute rule, because it just seems to me, in terms of fairness, for someone to go on for 9.5 and others for 8, in this type of setting, is not allowable. So I shall be brutal and call out and just stand up and walk back to the lectern after 8 minutes is over. No extra time whatsoever. All right, now, the order, we're going to go in. We couldn't really decide if there are any criteria for the order except an alphabetical one. So we're going to start with Mahatma Gandhi, and I'm delighted to invite Professor Peter Townsend of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights to speak. Peter Townsend, as you know probably, well, you probably all know about him as the most persistent and distinguished student of contemporary poverty. I mean, if one recited some of the things that Peter Townsend has done in his life, it would take all evening anyway. But he's currently Professor of International Social Policy at LSE, and it seems to me he has been, for years and years, one of the leading social scientists in this country, a man who combines theory with practice in an absolutely exemplary manner. So I'm delighted to introduce Peter Townsend, who's going to speak as or for Mahatma Gandhi.
Mahatma Gandhi was the originator and the most influential exponent of human rights in the 20th century. He was born in 1869 into a relatively privileged family, 8 years before Queen Victoria assumed the title of Empress of India. Married off at 13, he later denounced the cruel system of child marriage. He came to question the hierarchical caste structure of Indian society. In 1898, when he was 19, he came to study law in London, and after being called to the bar 3 years later, returned briefly to India. He found he was clumsy in court and had stage fright. He retreated into drafting applications and memorials to earn a living, but then got the chance of going to South Africa for a year as a legal assistant in 1893. That year marked him for life. Despite having a first-class ticket to attend the legal case in Pretoria, he was thrown off the train and later thrown out of a horse-drawn coach. He was a coloured coolie. He investigated the social and economic conditions of the Indian community and worked to organise and represent them. He helped Hindus, Muslims and Parsis to oppose disenfranchisement in South Africa. He set up the Natal Indian Congress. The nervous Indian barrister turned into the champion of the rights of the downtrodden and the oppressed. He quickly became a public figure. He acquired confidence in legal representation, was admitted as an advocate in the Supreme Court, and brought his family to South Africa in 1896. There were hostile and even violent objections at his arrival at the quayside for several weeks. In 1899, when the Boer War started, he raised an Indian ambulance corps of over 1,000 and led them in marches and field operations to rescue injured and dead. He pushed through the Indian National Congress a resolution in support of 100,000 Indians in South Africa. In the Transvaal, he urged Indians to oppose a new law requiring them to carry permits. Satyagraha, passive resistance or non-violent non-cooperation, became his most powerful weapon. As a consequence, he endured further acts of personal violence and periods in prison. He started to call attention to the gifts of low-paid craftsmen. He set up an agrarian commune. After leaving South Africa in 1914, he became a preeminent political figure. He took initiatives to seek equality for Harijans or untouchables, to argue for the rights of indigo farmers in Bihar, to fast when a wage claim for textile workers was unjustly rejected, and to suspend payments of land revenue in areas where peasants were experiencing famine because of the failure of crops in Kedah. After 1918, he went public about the need for Britain to confer self-rule. But a day of non-violent national strike and demonstrations led to official opposition and the catastrophic Amritsar massacre of 400. India was now set on a collision course against imperial government. He was jailed for 2 years. Afterwards, he set a personal example by touring the country and adopting the spinning wheel and the use of khadi, hand-spun and hand-woven cloth, as powerful symbols of the revival of cottage industries in India, as well as opposition to exploitative, industrialized Britain. In 1930, as a test case, Gandhi had the imaginative idea to lead a march for 250 miles to collect seawater to evaporate and turn into salt. In open defiance of the new law, of the law imposing a salt tax, widely perceived as a tax on the poor. This symbolic march fired the imagination of the entire nation. He condemned the oppression of women and of the very poor. He wanted the people of different religions to live together. He worked tirelessly against the communal riots and fratricide of 1947. When independence was granted and partition, contrary to his arguments, finally became a reality. 1 million died in the panic and aggression of migration between Hindu and Muslim areas. Hindu extremists wanted the revival of ancient Hindu India and objected to his advocacy of a single state and his protection of the life and honor of Muslims. He was assassinated on the 30th of January 1948. At the end of that same year, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was signed by 48 states at the General Assembly of the United Nations. It stands as a memorial to his life struggle. Martin Luther King found his message about nonviolence electrifying and used it to good effect in boycotting city buses in Montgomery, Alabama. Nelson Mandela was influenced by Gandhi's achievements for Indians as well as reconciliation and forgiveness between whites and blacks in South Africa. The Roosevelts were deeply influenced by his argument, by his example, especially Eleanor when she was engaged in the preparation of drafts of the Universal Declaration. He had a sharp sense of humour. When asked in 1931 in London why he wore a loincloth only, he said, you wear plus fours, I wear minus fours. And when asked by a reporter why he dared go to Buckingham Palace in his informal dress to meet the King and Queen, he replied with a smile, the King was wearing enough for both of us. Indian independence lit the fuse that prompted the dissolution of the British Empire and the retreat of imperialism from over 60 countries in the next 20 years. Gandhi practiced human rights as no man or woman has before or since. On the scores of advocacy of the rights of gender, race, religion, age, and disability, he is unique. On one occasion, he said, I will open the windows of my house to all religions of the world, but I do not intend to be blown down by any one of them.
Be a bit more like what a university challenge, really, shouldn't it? Do you remember when it all shows all those daft people who I'm sure are never students because they never look like students, so they all wave things around and go Gandhi, Gandhi, Gandhi. Anyway, now I'm going to be very strict on time because that was 7 minutes 20 seconds, and we're going to have 2 minutes for the question, so you have earned yourself 40 seconds extra. So 2 minutes 40 for you are allowed, Peter. So could we have questions from the audience addressed to Peter, which are related to the question of why on earth Gandhi should be allowed to stay in the balloon. Can I? Yes, but shall I have a question in the middle there? If you can, there's a microphone is coming round. Yes, in green, shall we?
It's not a question, it's in support, a comment. I would like to say, because of two reasons. One is that whatever Gandhi negated, he also proposed and lived the alternatives that he had proposed. So that makes him, it's not only negation of something, but proposing some alternative to that. That's one. And second thing is, I think compared to all other personalities that we have today, Gandhi also lived for all the values that he practiced. I mean, he died for the values that he practiced. Because there was, when India became independent, there was a chance that he could have become a very important political figure. But he denied and he chose to go and live with people and die for the people who were affected by the riots, very worst riots in the history of subcontinent. So I think these are two points that make the argument in case of Gandhi. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have one more person. The only criteria I'm using that I'm moving around. So I shall go to the blue. Lady in the blue. Yes, with your hand up there, yes. In the third row from the back. Sir, thank you. This is the second question or statement. I know you squeezed in two there, by the way. I heard you saying so, and a second point. Anyway, I'll let that off. So that evening.
Hi, Mahatma Gandhi was once asked why he travelled in a third class compartment of trains, and I'm told that his answer was because there's no fourth class. Do you believe that should he win today's debate, he would agree to go in the balloon and remain in the balloon as such a self-effacing character?
Yeah. Good point.
Thank you both.
Yeah. Good point. Excellent. Peter. Don't jump anywhere.
You have 45 seconds to respond.
In a sense, I don't feel that those were questions that need answering, but merely, as it were, expanding the multidimensional quality of the man himself. I was very young when the assassination was announced, and he was in those days, for my generation, it was a kind of distant figure who was lampooned repeatedly
in the press, and it occurred to me that such a figure being lampooned so frequently reminds one very much of today's figures, and that applied to all of the people being spoken for on this particular platform. I suppose I would want to issue as supreme in the values he upheld was that kind of self-effacing but leadership quality.
Thank you very much indeed. Enormous support obviously already evident in the audience for Gandhi, but let's see how much of that support is still there after we've heard from our next speaker, who is Shami Chakrabarty, the director of Liberty. I just reminded her when we were in the ante room or green room or whatever that sludgy place next door is called, that she only came 23rd in, if you've seen Time Out today, she was only listed as 23rd in Time Out's 100 top Londoners. It seems to me quite disgusting. She's not one or two in that. She should be first, not only director of Liberty, but one of the most potent opponents of the repressive anti-terrorist measures which this government has tried to introduce. I think if we're talking about the way in which the government can be seen in some respects to be rowing back on some of those anti-repressive measures, we must credit Shami with a great deal of that. So here she is to speak on behalf of, I don't think you're speaking in the first person, are you? No? You are sort of, half and half, pronomically different. So let me welcome, please, Shami, to speak for Martin Luther King.
Thank you. Question: how do you speak for the greatest human rights orator of the modern era? Answer: in his own words and with some considerable trepidation. Those of you who think that you know the legendary Lincoln Memorial speech of 1963 will just have to forgive me if I suggest that, like our own consciences or a dear familiar friend so easily taken for granted, we don't know its full depth and current resonance nearly as well as we should. Here's what Dr. King himself said about the speech. I started out reading the speech and read it down to a point. The audience's response was wonderful that day. And all of a sudden, this thing came to me. The previous June, following a peaceful assemblage of thousands of people through the streets of downtown Detroit, Michigan, I delivered a speech in Cobo Hall. And I'd used the phrase, "I have a dream." I'd used it many times before, but I just felt I wanted to use it here. I don't know why. I hadn't thought about it before the speech. I used the phrase, and at that point I just turned aside from the manuscript altogether and didn't come back to it. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied as long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We cannot be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating "for whites only." We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No. No, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I'm not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom has left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi, go back to Alabama, go back to South Carolina, go back to Georgia, go back to Louisiana, go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friends, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. In Britain, at this precise moment in the history of our rights and freedoms, far from ejecting Dr. King from the balloon, it's high time, in my view, to remember and study his message. And time to question whether those of us engaged in the struggle for dignity, equality, and justice are really honouring his promise, are really worthy of his legacy. Let's remember, first of all, that he talked of the dream that could be and not the nightmare that was. America in the 1960s wasn't, to quote the present chair of our CRE, sleepwalking into a segregated society. To a great extent, it was that reality. Dr. King inspired a movement with the positive vision and values, not the nightmare. Secondly, the dream was importantly rooted in the American dream. In sharp contrast with the current trendy navel-gazing about Britishness that marks a new chic xenophobia on the part of so-called progressives, Dr. King sought no new highway code for living together, once more to quote Trevor Phillips, but returned to the code, the promissory note already laid down in the United States Bill of Rights. Thirdly, he neither condoned self-segregation and victimhood, nor did he take the soft option of picking easy fights with the powerless. He did the tough stuff of uniting both the right-thinking and the oppressed, and of taking on those with power on the basis of constitutional and moral principle, not mere self-interest. Like modern British race equality leaders, he was not averse to courting headlines and shaking society up, but he always had a positive vision of where he wanted the pieces to settle in the end. If he were around here today, it's my contention that he would have been as exercised about torture, stop and search, and the plight of asylum seekers as with discrimination by private people and institutions. His vision would be of a Britain where the play Beshti is performed and where people have a right to wear religious dress. I truly believe that he would support wholeheartedly the end of segregated commissions to be replaced by the Commission for Equalities and Human Rights. Dr. King's moral authority came not from a vested interest in greater justice, but from the even-handedness and unifying nature of his vision. We need him in the balloon. But more importantly, we should keep him in mind and judge modern leaders and campaigners by those exacting standards. Thank you.
What an easy job it is to be chair. 7 minutes, 20 seconds, which means to say there are 2 minutes, 40 seconds again left for comments or questions, from the audience about Martin Luther King. Yes, can I see any raised hands at all? Anybody? Yes, right at the very back.
Just to say that I couldn't agree more with your statement that Martin Luther King is the most fantastic orator in terms of human rights. But I just wanted to say, put a point to you, would you think that his morality in his private life, in terms of fidelity or lack of it, and allegations at the time about the standard of living, travelling, campaigning of him and some of the NAACP leaders, perhaps in contrast to Gandhi, would detract from a claim that he is the greatest of the 20th century.
Thank you very much. And I'll take another point before I come back to you, Sean. Is that right? Yes, please.
I mean, I don't worship any of these people, but I want to mention one thing, you know, that I actually, when I read this about Martin Luther King, it shocked me, unsettled me. After 1967, Israeli, occupation of Palestine, I would say, he had not even few words for the people who were occupied. Instead, what did he do? He supported the Israeli establishment, Israeli government, and I'm shocked that, you know, this is a big failure on his part to speak up for the people, for same people, similar people like in America that he was fighting for. He failed them, and he failed them grotesquely.
You have over a minute to respond.
Well, I think I'll link the two questions together. I'm not here to worship anyone, nor am I here to speak for a saint, nor am I here to search through the detail of every statement that Luther King never made, or of every train journey, perhaps not in third class. I think that the message speaks for itself, the record speaks for itself, and I'm not really going through I'm not doing the Daily Mail, historical Daily Mail through the bin search. So you know, the record speaks for itself, the values speak for themselves, I think.
Okay, thank you very much. I would just raise the tension slightly by reminding you that some of these people are going to be hurled from this balloon at an enormous distance, so it's a very, very serious matter, and I hope they're looking duly serious. And now we move on to the third speaker. Third speaker is Francesca Klug, a professorial research fellow in the Centre for the Study of Human Rights here at LSE. She spent 10 years campaigning for the introduction of the UK Human Rights Act and published the first account of that act. You look through some of her writings. A phrase that always stood out, I loved, was Home Secretaries dislike being told that their actions are unlawful. Isn't that a gentle sentiment? Okay, so to speak as or on behalf of Nelson Mandela, will you welcome Francesca Klug?
My name is Nelson Mandela. I am best known as the leader of one of the most monumental struggles of the 20th century against the system of apartheid, which in 1976 was declared a crime against humanity under international law. But the question for tonight, as I stand before you, my fate in your hands, is my contribution to the noble and enduring cause of human rights. I'm not asking you to save me from extinction because you think apartheid was a uniquely pernicious and brutal system. I'm not asking you to vote for me because I spent 27 years in prison for trying to overthrow that system, mostly doing hard labor on Robben Island. I'm asking you to save me because I led my people in the only successful human rights revolution the world has ever known. I'm not denying, of course, the importance of the French and American revolutions in establishing the idea of inalienable human rights, but the first ended in wholesale terror, that is where the word terrorism derives from, and the second defined slaves as 3/5 of a man in a constitution apparently dedicated to upholding life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not mine, clearly. No, nor am I overlooking the many important liberation struggles against colonialism and imperialism all over the world. But these have been mostly national struggles, usually cloaked in nationalist or Marxist rhetoric, and often involving wholesale slaughter of civilians, justified as necessary to achieve self-determination and independence. In contrast, our struggle was openly fought in the name of human rights. We did not argue that the ends justified the means. We argued that only human rights means will achieve our end. And our end was not to create an African nation where once there was a white nation, but to establish a society for all of South Africa's citizens based on equal rights, justice, and the rule of law. Let's take each of these in turn, if you don't believe me. First, what were we struggling for? You'll all recognize the statement I made from the dock in the Rivonia trial, which resulted in my life sentence, in which I said I fought against white domination, I fought against black domination, I've cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which we all live together. It's an ideal for which I hope to live and to achieve. But if needs be, it's an ideal for which I'm prepared to die, although preferably not by falling off a balloon. In championing equality for all, I took a decisively different path to the nationalists in the Pan-African Congress who opposed democratic elections that could lead to a multiracial government. Ours was a struggle for the equal worth and dignity of every individual, and it was the lack of human dignity that I explicitly took as the main line of my defence at the Rivonia trial. And because I challenged our oppression from the point of view of human dignity and not just racial equality, I drew much inspiration from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or UDHR, adopted in 1948 just as apartheid was formally introduced. As I wrote later, the declaration was proof that we were not alone, but part of a global movement against racism, colonialism, and for human rights and peace and justice. That's what we were fighting for, not just against racism, but for human rights and justice. Second, how did I fight the system using human rights principles? When I stood in the dock defending myself from a likely death sentence, I said, I think in the circumstances I'm obliged to state exactly what my political beliefs are. I'm an admirer of the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights. These are documents which are held in veneration by Democrats all over the world. Almost uniquely amongst all the liberation movements fighting colonialism and oppression, we in the African National Congress, which I had the honour to lead, developed a programme for human rights, social and economic and cultural, as well as civil and political. When it was quite unfashionable to argue this, we insisted there could be no liberation without enforceable human rights and a democratic system of government, all dismissed as bourgeois rights by many socialist and Marxist comrades in liberation movements elsewhere. The 1955 Freedom Charter, which formed the basis of our programme, was neither a communist or capitalist document, as I explained in my autobiography. With its chapter on equal human rights, it's easy to see in the Freedom Charter the influence of the UDHR. But what is particularly important is that it was an African contribution to human rights, developed for the specific conditions of South Africa, adopted through a Congress of the People. But you will say, I practice violence, unlike the saintly Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. How can I argue that I base my struggle on human rights when I supported terrorism? I do not deny, and indeed I am proud, that my comrades and I formed Umkhonto Weseswa, the spear of the nation, after all channels of peaceful and protest and democratic protest had failed. But it is a mistake to confuse human rights principles with pacifism. Does not the UDHR preamble itself acknowledge that if human rights are to be not protected by the rule of law, man may be compelled to have recourse as a last resort to rebellion against tyranny and oppression? Yes, I was charged and found guilty of sabotage, but as I said from the dock, the violence which we chose to adopt was not terrorism. Terrorism denotes targeting innocent individuals. We chose to adopt sabotage and later guerrilla warfare precisely because it did not involve the loss of innocent life. Finally, we've built a nation based on human rights foundations. When apartheid was over, we set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, controversial, I know, because we judged that adversarial justice would mean that half the nation, black as well as white, would have to be put on trial. Through the reconciliation process, we gave public acknowledgement to human rights abuses carried out by supporters of the liberation struggle. Who else did that? We don't need Stalin's legacy to establish that the deliberate killing of innocent civilians is a stain that no liberation struggle can ultimately justify. We drew this wisdom from human rights principles themselves. The new South Africa is built on the rock, not just of struggle, but of a written constitution and Bill of Rights, which has inspired human rights defenders all over the world. The first act of our Supreme Court was to abolish the death penalty. Sure, the new South Africa is far from perfect, but the world that once shunned South Africa now looks at us for leadership. The center of gravity for human rights innovations has moved from the west to the south, largely through our example. I'm a humble man, but I put it to you that if I am known as the embodiment of the moral conscience of mankind, it's because I alone have demonstrated, in word and in deed, not only the moral worth of human rights, but their power to transform. I've established they can be used not only to overthrow old oppressive regimes, but build new, just, and tolerant ones. So we needed the wise words of Eleanor Roosevelt's UDHR to inspire us, and maybe even George Orwell's allegories to warn us. But we alone have demonstrated that human rights can provide a motor for transformation and change that does not detour into tyranny and bloodshed, but is guided by basic ethical principles we know to be right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nelson Mandela. It begins to get to you in a time, doesn't it? Because you think, good heavens, perhaps these people are here. Because I've got to announce, by the way, I didn't mention it before, because I was told, well, there's a reception after this, but I'm not telling you where it is. Because apparently I've been told that if you mention in the LSE that there are free drinks somewhere, everybody leaves the room. I can't imagine them leaving. But it's an indication of how much one's getting involved in this, and I'm already wondering whether there are sufficient soft drinks for Mahatma Gandhi. Now, now we move on now to the fourth speaker today, who is Conor Gerty, the rousing director.
Questions.
Sorry?
Questions.
You're quite right. Absolutely.
You're listening.
So I'm getting carried away with the apprehension of being standing next to such distinguished people. I'm forgetting my own script. We have 2 minutes for questions. That was exactly 8 minutes long. So, two questions. Yes, thank you very much. Gentlemen, two rows from the back.
Is there anything that you regret?
We'll wait and have. We'll perhaps take another question. what admirable brevity. Yes, and we may as well there. I think that is. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes, please.
One thing I wanted to find out, your view would be the sharing of the Nobel Peace Prize with F.W. de Klerk. What were your feelings on that?
Okay, I'm going to take one more question, because he's been so admirably brief, he's going to take one more question down here, so let's make the third one. I'm just changing the rules of time as I'm going along. Yes, okay. Yes, I will.
I just want to add 2 points to what she has said. He was chained, brutalized, tortured, made to break stones, incarcerated for 27 years. Still, he made persistent opposed to human rights. Greater efforts were made to kill him, but because he was not ordained to be killed by a human being, that was why he remained unkilled. After the tribulation, he became liberated, he became president. Still, he remained focused for human rights, and he gave equal rights to both members of a party and opponents. He made the focus his life for the betterment of human beings.
Thank you very much. Nelson, you wish to respond?
Is there anything I regret? I think there are two things that immediately come to mind. One is that I was not able to spend any of my life with my family before they were fully grown up, and I will carry that burden with me all my life. But thankfully, finally, I'm spending a little bit of time with my grandchildren, and I suppose the fact that I prefer to do that rather than stay as president of South Africa eternally might mean that I might be rewarded by not being thrown down those steps and into the cold air in a few minutes' time. And as for sharing the Nobel Peace Prize with de Klerk, de Klerk was my enemy, but he was also the means to our salvation. Because the reason why South Africa is the emblem of human rights in the world is because my people were able to make peace, to face down the demons inside us that want to destroy and say, you have done terrible things to us. We know that. But you, in the end, allowed, without bloodshed, peace to happen. And for that reason, I was very happy to stand there and receive a Nobel Peace Prize. And as for my friend in the front, all I can say is I am a humble man, but I agree with everything you said about me.
Yeah, thank you. Well, now, I think it was probably my excitement getting the better of me because I was racing on to Conor Gerty before his time, but I'm excited to hear from Professor Conor Gerty, who is, of course, the rousing director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights and Professor of Human Rights Law here at LSE, still a practising barrister. If you'd like to read an excellent piece on the future of human rights. It is, in a way, a distillation of the Hamlin lectures that he recently gave. Then I advise you to buy the next edition of The New Humanist, which will be on sale in January. So can I invite, I don't know whether I'm inviting Connor or whether I'm inviting George Orwell, to put their case for staying in the balloon.
Neither. My name... Dealness. My name is Eric Blair. I'm very glad I changed it. Wouldn't be a promising surname, nor is my school Eton. I gather nowadays it's almost impossible to succeed as a public figure if you've been to Eton, and let's hope that continues to be true. You need me in this balloon. You need me today. These incredible people, it's been fascinating in this balloon. They're fascinating people. Some of them talk a little bit. One or two of them say they're modest, and in fact, when you scratch under the surface, it's hard to interrupt them. You need me because way back, I said the 20th century was a century when human equality became technically possible. But I also said in one of my books, books that people read today still, no royalties when you're dead. The 20th century is also a time when it's possible for practices which have long been abandoned, in some cases for hundreds of years, this is me in the 1940s, imprisonment without trial, the use of war prisoners as slaves, public execution, torture to extract confessions, the use of hostages, the deportation of whole populations, not only become common again, but are tolerated and even defended by people who consider themselves enlightened and progressive. I said that in the 1940s, and I think you need me in this balloon because I think it's as true today as it was then. Do you remember one of the guys that I thought about? I knew this bloke, George Bernard Shaw, an Irish fellow, and I modeled one of my people on him. He's dead, I gather, though it took him a long time. A guy called O'Brien. O'Brien was the co-author, you remember, of The Theory and Practice of Oligarchic Collectivism. Now, O'Brien is around us today, and we need to expose him. O'Brien is the man who tortured Winston. O'Brien is the man who said, it's better to torture than to shoot. O'Brien is the man who said, the object of torture is torture. And O'Brien is the liberal intellectual who knows which way the world is going. O'Brien is the kind of man who says today, torture's all right if you have a judicial warrant. O'Brien's the kind of man who says today, you should never use evidence secured as a result of torture, but the onus is on the accused to prove that the evidence has been so obtained. O'Brien is the kind of person we see everywhere arguing that human rights now requires us to destroy people, to use chemical weapons to protect people from chemical weapons. O'Brien is our paradigm liberal, and he needs to be exposed. I think I would have liked Harold Pinter, you know. I've been reading in the papers his speech yesterday. You need more of that in this culture. In 1984, there was a postscript. The bleakness I held out a hope. The hope was that it was history, do you remember? It was history. It had gone. It goes if you can keep people like Harold Pinter on the go, if you can keep people who are on this platform on the go, fighting for a brand of truth which is against cruelty and for prosperity. You need me because there aren't many of those people around. You need to keep me in the balloon to ensure that that postscript continues, that Rumsfeld is history, that the liberal intellectuals who say that torture is all right as long as a judge sanctions it are regarded as history and not the leaders of our culture. You also need me because I spotted first. I'll be absolutely clear about it. None of this false modesty from me. It's too dangerous up here in the balloon. Though I might jump myself if I have to listen to more of these modest people. Because I spotted first the difference between the unacceptability of capitalism. If you read my Road to Wigan Pier, I went to Eton. I know what power and privilege are like, and I can't stand it. I'm glad that old Mahatma went to a good school as well. We must have a chat later. I wasn't aware of that. But I spotted the communist thing too. I spotted my mate Joe here. Most of you had to wait for Alexander, what's his name, Solzhenitsyn and the Gulag Archipelago. You were all going round the place in the 70s and 80s saying, oh, I can't believe it, there were labour camps. I knew it. I wrote about it. That was the point. That was the point of my Animal Farm. I spotted that that wasn't the route to a better human future. Now, you read my stuff on Spain. You read my stuff on the workers. Homage to Catalonia, the Road to Wigan Pier, and you'll see the answer that I give. The answer, democratic socialism. The answer is trust the people. The answer is human rights and human flourishing through the people. Now, there is something in my background I want to mention. I met this woman. She worked for the Foreign Office, Celia Kerwin. She's a very nice lady. I sent a list to the Foreign Office. I was sick. I wish I'd added that name, the hisser. I sent 38 people. I said, this is what I said. I said, these aren't people who should be trusted as propagandists for the West. That's what I was sending. Don't trust these people as propagandists for the West. It's not such a heinous crime. I wish I'd done it more. I wish I'd included more people because the stakes were high. It was rooting out Joe's lot. And Joe's coming a bit later on, and he might actually come clean tonight. He's beyond anxieties now. How many of them really were his people? I think perhaps I mightn't have been wrong about Tom Dreiberg, you know. I certainly don't think I was wrong about Peter Smollett, you know, a journalist for The Express. He's the civil servant who, when he was sent Animal Farm to read, said it wasn't worth publishing. And I was held back by that. TB was made worse by it. These are the people whom I said to the British government authorities who had just won a war against fascism, who were attempting to maintain democratic socialism in the face of Stalinism, don't use these guys to be your propagandists. I didn't say throw them in jail. I didn't say send them to any of Joe's camps. I said don't use them as propagandists. Is that such a terrible thing? I am proud of what I did in those tough times. Protecting democratic socialism is the surest way to protect human rights. Now, I need to stay in this balloon because I'm not well. I'm not well. And I gather there's a new there's a new thing. There's antibiotics. And I'm all right. I'm all right if I could just be left for a little bit longer. So you need me as a propagandist. I'm on the verge of good health, so keep me there to save me. Thank you very much.
I'm not sure whether or not I should allow these last sort of appeals. It's going to get worse and worse. And I mean, people will be throwing money. People will be throwing money into the audience by the end. Could you just give a little sort of a little cough from time to time to arouse further sympathy? We have two and a half minutes for questions here now. I'm just going to the balcony first, because we've only had one person from there. Can I have the person in the third row, then, just rather arbitrarily?
Hi. While I don't dispute the value of your writing, Mr. Orwell, I do believe that the greatest of all human rights advocates is someone who's accessible to all. What about the 2 billion or so people that haven't read your books, and how have you been able to get sort of influence their thinking and their value of human rights?
Thank you very much. I'll come down to the audience over here. Shall I take this gentleman in the second row here?
You were a colonial police officer for a couple years, upholding the system that Gandhi was fighting against. How does this help or kind of hurt your status as a human rights personality?
Yeah, you have about just over a minute to respond.
Thank you very much. In reverse order. Yeah, I was, yeah. I was. Roger Casement, I knew him briefly.
he suffered as an oppressor for a while too. You make a journey in life. It's important. It's very important to be open to the experiences of the life. Not always to just be a chameleon fitting in with your environment, but learning from the world. And I learned. As you know, I don't do things by halves. You know, I mean, if I'm writing about the poor, I'm poor. And if I'm writing about colonial experiences, I've experienced it as a colonial oppressor. And I found that, broadly speaking, advantageous. And I'm not ashamed. One of the very, very rare criticisms of me is that I'm not accessible. I don't know whether you could say that the author of Animal Farm is not accessible. The author of 1984 is not accessible. You mean, and you intend to mean it, and I'm not intending to imply that you don't intend to mean this complicated. I can do LSE jargon when I feel like it. Is that it's not read, and those 2 billion people want to read it. Joe leaned over, with whom I must say I'm getting on extremely well. I'm beginning rare, as it is, kind of point of view. They had a real problem in the gulags because they were reading Samstag versions of my stuff. It really was a bit of a problem for Joe. He had to remove it. And we're aiming for literacy, and we're aiming to create the conditions where 1984 and Animal Farm are available and Homage to Catalonia in every decent country. The only other thing I'd say is, with the old antibiotics, the voice will get stronger, and that balloon is circling the world. And I can remember long patches of the books, and I can simply shout it out.
Thank you very much, George and Eric and Connor. The tension is really mounting, isn't it? Because, and in fact, you know what's going to happen. After we've taken the vote, people are going to be physically ejected from this platform. They're going to be removed from this stage, and we're going to be left with just two people to argue the case. So we are getting only about 20 minutes away from the vote. There was nearly a slightly embarrassing moment because I was told that the next speaker tonight would be, in fact, appearing wearing... wearing a frock. So anxious was he to appear in character. So consequently, I'm afraid that I erroneously addressed the director of events at LSE as Eleanor when she greeted me tonight. This is the real Eleanor. Anyway, Eleanor Isabel. And this is the real Jonathan Cooper, director of the Human Rights Programme for the Centre on International Courts and Tribunals at UCL, and a course convener for the LSE's certificate in international human rights law and practice, and formerly Assistant Director of Justice. Will you please welcome Eleanor Roosevelt?
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm actually speaking to you today as myself. I'm here to talk to you about my relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt and how she's affected my life. And it is worth all of us reflecting upon and remembering how, when, why, and why we became committed to human rights standards. For me, it was back in the mid-1980s during the AIDS crisis, where the treatment of people with AIDS or those suspected of having AIDS was appalling. People were literally attacked, they were humiliated, they were ostracized, and they were demonized. As it happened, as well as being sacked from their work and made homeless, as it happened, I worked with the haemophilia community at the time, and I saw the consequences of the hysteria around AIDS on that community firsthand. I think, just to give you an example of the treatment that people were subjected to, the women whose partners had haemophilia and those women who may have become pregnant, they would be tested, often without their consent, and if tested for HIV and found to be positive, their pregnancies would be terminated, and on more than one occasion, they would be sterilized, again, without their consent. That's just one example of the type of atrocities that were being committed against people with or affected by HIV and AIDS in the mid and late 1980s. Now, the communities affected by AIDS were frightened, angry, and helpless. And what we did was we came together and we, rather controversially, agreed to draft a Declaration of Rights for people with AIDS. We knew which of our rights were being violated, and we knew what rights we needed. But what we didn't know was how we could articulate these rights. And then we discovered the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, and the treaties that have flowed from it. And all of a sudden, we had our framework, our solution for how to devise our very own Declaration of Rights for people with HIV and AIDS. And all the rights in that declaration that we drafted had already been adopted by the UN and then put into the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the subsequent human rights treaties. And therefore, we were able to rely upon the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in drafting our own declaration, and it made a real difference. It made a real difference to the lives of people living with AIDS. It gave people hope, it gave people confidence, and it gave people a sense of dignity. So what is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Where does it come from? Well, it's an inspirational document, and I'm sure most of you here have read it. It articulates the rights that the UN is mandated to protect. It was drafted immediately after the Second World War as the first achievement of the newly formed UN Human Rights Commission. And it has subsequently become the basis of all later UN and regional human rights treaties. And, to all intents and purposes, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights is now customary international law. Without the person that I am here representing tonight, we would not have the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. Without Eleanor Roosevelt, there would be no UDHR. Eleanor was the first chair of the Human Rights Commission. Her first priority was to catalogue the rights that would form the basis of the Commission's work and the UN's mandate. She was an extraordinarily exceptional woman, and she gathered around her, as part of her drafting committee, the leading intellects in the world. These included Dr. Chang, a Chinese Confucian philosopher, Charles Malik, a Lebanese philosopher, René Cassin, lawyer, victim of the Holocaust, veteran of the First World War, and arguably the greatest Frenchman of the 20th century. Eleanor, who had no formal education of her own, took the high ideals of these great men and translated them into the working language of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And the document that was agreed upon was drawn up, yes, this is true, it was drawn up in response to the atrocities that had been committed in the first half of the 20th century. However, it is a document of timeless application and one that is designed to address violations of human rights standards and the arbitrary exercise of power whenever those violations of human rights standards occur and whoever is exercising that power. It is ingenious in its simplicity, and it is as relevant today as it was in 1950 and will be in 2050. The perpetrators of hatred and violence may have changed. However, the role of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights and the human rights which it promulgates in combating them will not. The UDHR is as valuable today in combating the current experiences that we are going through as it was back in the 1940s in addressing the atrocities that had occurred during the 30s and 40s. And what Eleanor managed to do was to ensure consensus in relation to that Universal Declaration. It was adopted unanimously by the General Assembly, albeit with 5 extensions, no surprises who abstained, Stalin's Soviet Union, and of course the oppressors of Nelson Mandela, and then the Saudi Arabian regime. The UDHR, therefore, is a global commitment to human rights, and it reflects a global commitment to human rights. It's an extraordinary achievement, considering that the Cold War was emerging and the diversity of cultures, opinions, and religions at the United Nations. Now, I know the UDHR gets accused of cultural relativism, and admittedly, the UN was smaller than it is today, but the United Nations adopted it, and the values of the UDHR are consistently reaffirmed by the global community. But the striking thing about the UDHR is we would not have it without Eleanor Roosevelt. It was her achievement. Without her, it would not have been possible. It was her humanitarian convictions that gave us its breadth and depth. It's a document that contains civil and political rights and economic and social rights, but it was her political astuteness that got it through the General Assembly just in time before the Cold War hunkered down. Now, for that reason alone, Eleanor Roosevelt must stay in this balloon, because without her, we don't have modern human rights standards. She is the fountain of modern human rights. But if that's not enough, you just need to look at her work in the United States. I would never question the fact that the civil rights movement grew up through the oppressed black communities, particularly in the southern states of America. But it was Eleanor who helped lay down the framework for race and sexual equality in the United States. Yes, she had been married to the president, and she used that influence to ensure that humanitarian causes got on the political agenda. And it was Eleanor, 10 years before Brown and the Board of Education, when she was openly critical of segregation and called the separate and equal doctrines absurd, and wherever possible she would flout the rules of segregation. She was a self-deprecating woman and would of course be the first to jump out of the balloon at this stage when faced with such great people. But this debate isn't about the greatest of the 20th century, it's about the greatest human rights activist of the 20th century, and that is Eleanor Roosevelt, because without her, we have no human rights. It is worth reflecting upon one person who commented on Eleanor Roosevelt, and she said, and he said, that she would rather light a candle than curse the darkness. That's an amazingly profound comment, that she would rather light a candle than curse the darkness. The Universal Declaration on Human Rights is that candle. It has given hope and aspiration to the world and its oppressed and dispossessed. Without her, we wouldn't have it. And for me, discovering and understanding the UDHR has changed my life, both personally and professionally. It changed the lives of people who were living with AIDS in the United Kingdom in the 1980s. And it is as available to the world's community as it was to those people back then in the 1980s, where it really did change their lives and affect fundamental difference. And it is for this reason that Eleanor Roosevelt is and always will be the greatest human rights activist of all time. Thank you very much.
And I suppose that you might want to regard the whole of this evening as an example of a sort of I'm a professor, get me out of here in a way, really. But it's considerably more momentous than this, because these people up here are not being asked to crawl through buckets of live frogs or tarantulas. They're actually going to be thrown over the edge of the gondola and fall thousands of feet to a very ugly death. So can we have some questions to Eleanor, please? Thank you. Where can I go? I haven't spoken before, have you? You have, yes. Yeah. So I will. Yes, at the back. In the back room? Somebody in the back room? I see somebody in the back room.
There's a chap at the back there, yeah.
Okay, I've got upstairs now. Yes, upstairs. Thank you.
Hi. Good evening. Huh? I agree everyone did a really great and did really good contribution to human rights. But my idea is there should no one people greater than anyone in human rights. By human rights, I mean everyone is equal. Human rights mean everyone born to be totally equal human being. No anyone greater than anyone or less greater than anyone. Also, I don't think one people can do human rights without, even these people are very great people, they can't do all the human rights problem. We need everyone to do it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I suppose you always get a deconstructionist, really, don't you? I take your point. But anyway, we have to do it one at a time here today. Yes, thank you very much in the second row.
Hi, I just wondered if Eleanor felt a bit lonely being the only woman in the balloon.
That's a very nice point. Right, you have a minute left, Eleanor.
Thank you. If I could just address the question for the gentleman in the balcony. I agree with you. It can't be just one person that could be the greatest human rights person of all time. And Eleanor certainly would be embarrassed to be even being considered to be that person. But I think it's very clear that we can say who is not the greatest human rights person of all time, which is Stalin. And I should point out that whilst my committee were drafting the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, I was consistently hampered by my efforts in drafting that declaration, thanks to the disgusting tactics of the Soviet Union. To pick up on your point, and we nearly didn't have the Universal Declaration on Human Rights thanks to the tactics of the Soviet Union, but I outmaneuvered them.
As you continue to do.
I've been lonely all my life.
It's something antibiotics can't cure.
How long have you got? But one thing I have done is I've found tremendous solace by a great number of good, close women friends who supported me through a lot of very, very difficult times, including, obviously, my husband's affair, yes, which I'm now very open about and feel much happier about. But as a result of that affair, we developed separate lives and I became a stronger, better person. But I stayed with him and our love grew, so...
It's, there you go. I don't know what we're going to do with all these characters shifting their position. We've got the terminally ill, the feminist ingratiation. We've got it all going on. All right, okay, so we now move to the last person. This is really getting exciting. Somebody's leaving, I can't believe it. But the last person we turn to, I think who has been really indicted, maligned, whatever word you might choose, throughout the course of the evening. Fortunately, he is here to speak for himself, and I'm delighted that he is. His alter ego is Andrew Puddiford, who is formerly executive director of Article 19, the International Human Rights Organization. He's now a visiting fellow at the Center for the Study of Human Rights, and he's a former General Secretary of Liberty. So I'm delighted to welcome, if I can say after all that, Joseph Stalin.
So what am I doing here with all these wet liberals? I'm not a very nice person. They're not as nice as they say they are, but I'm really unpleasant. I'm one of the most unpleasant people of the 20th century, and anyone who votes for me for that because they like me needs their head examining. I don't claim to be a champion of human rights. I despise human rights as weak-minded trickery, and I've done everything in my power to undermine it and destroy it, as Eleanor found out. But this is the London School of Economics. You're not here to use your hearts or the flabby bits of your body. You're here to use your brains. This was founded by two of my greatest admirers, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, who, if we're here today, would be telling you to vote for me. I'm going to argue that my actions in the 20th century did more to promote the idea of universalism and human rights than the actions of anyone else in this balloon. See, human rights have been part of philosophy, Western philosophy, for many years. John Locke, Thomas Paine, the American and the French revolutions, all of them took the concept of human rights as their fundamental basis. And there was a prospect in human history of human rights forming the core of radical thought for the rest of history. Karl Marx understood, quite rightly in my view, the danger of this kind of sentimentality and bourgeois utopianism. He foresaw the need of Marxism to colonize the space of those who care about social justice and equity and substitute itself and its harsh but scientific doctrine of dialectical materialism. Because if human rights had stayed at the center of radical thought, communism could never have achieved the dominance it did, and the communist parties could never have acted the way they did. And so successful was Karl that by the late 19th century, it was Marxism that defined radical thinking and not human rights. This was Marx's greatest achievement, much more than anything else. I couldn't have achieved what I achieved without Karl's very important groundwork. And in the great clash of the 20th century ideologies of capitalism and communism, where I admit we've had a little setback recently, human rights was utterly marginalised. People talk about the Nazis and the Holocaust as the major human rights catastrophe of the 20th century. Well, in the 1930s, when fascism was appearing, and all but the most stupid of the upper classes could see that, where did people look for support to the Soviet Union? When we created the Popular Front, Western intellectuals flocked to our side, and yes, George, they were all my people. The Red Army broke the back of Nazi armies. Our prestige and power was never higher than it had been in 1945, and our right to rule in Eastern Europe was conceded by the United States, by Mrs. Roosevelt's husband, by Mr. Churchill and the other allies, who are quite happy to betray the Poles, the Czechs, and their other allies whose human rights they cared for not a fig. What role did human rights play in the defeat of fascism? Nothing. How many human rights divisions were there? None. So why did this fantastically ridiculous ideology take a hold after the war? Was it H.G. Wells making the argument, another old friend of mine, or Franklin himself with his Four Freedoms speech? I've always got on very well with Mr. Roosevelt. No, they're not in the blooming meat. They don't count. I don't have to worry about them. I'm confident that if it hadn't been for certain tragic developments, the lesson of Nazi atrocities would have been to the world, vote communist, support the Communist Party, support Soviet Russia. We would have been the real victors of the defeat of fascism. But it all went wrong for me after the war. All that wretched publicity about oppression in the Soviet Union, all those silly Cossacks committing suicide rather than coming home to be executed properly, all of those opposition to the policies of the Soviet Union, people caring about the arbitrary executions, the camps, the political prisoners, and all the other necessary measures we took in defense of the motherland. Without that sentimentality, generations of radicals would have seen communism as the antidote to fascism. It was the weak-minded, sentimental liberals who lost sight of the true goal of Soviet domination who turned to human rights. And it wasn't, if you think about it, until the collapse of the Soviet Union, the greatest tragedy of all our lifetimes, as George Galloway and many others have said, but human rights really took hold on the international stage. That's why I should be in the balloon. Because if it wasn't for the oppression of rights by a worker state, no one would ever assumed rights were universal and apply to everybody. Until I came along, nobody thought the left could do bad things. Some of them still can't. That's why that promising young fellow, Saddam Hussein, lasted so long. I had people coming to my country when I had 50 million people in labor camps, forced starvation, peasants slaughtering half their herds, the NKDV casting people off for execution on a quota basis, and still they came and said, it's a workers' paradise, apart from that nasty Mr. Orwell there. But nobody listened to him and nobody would publish him. So it took a long time for people to realize that human rights were universal, and without me they wouldn't have done it. That's why I should stay in the balloon, and that's why these poltroons should be shot, thrown out.
Well, that's admirably short. I'm so pleased we haven't got Castro in the balloon. We'd have been sitting there for never got on. It'd be 4.5 hours. We have ages. We have nearly 2 minutes over 2 minutes. So questions and comments. Yes, at the very back there, please. The microphone is just on its way.
Do you think the Russians would welcome you back?
Thank you very much. Did you hear that? Okay. All right. Okay. Let's. We'll take three more because we just have this little bit of extra time. Yes, up in the gallery.
Mr. Stalin, would you think it was a violation of your human rights if you were thrown out of the balloon for the good of the people?
Let me take just a couple more. We'll just add those in before we come back to Joseph. Yes, right down here in the front.
Do you think without you fascism wouldn't have been defeated? Obviously that was necessary for human rights to progress.
Thank you very much. And I'll take one more. I'm just looking around. Yes, in the fourth row back.
I hope we won't throw Marxism out of the balloon with Stalin, since he also persecuted Marxist scholars.
Joseph.
Well, you know, the Russians, when they got rid of me, they got capitalism, they didn't get human rights. So I think there are one or two people there who feel nostalgic for the old days. And I can understand that, and I'm ready to make a return anytime I get that call. But I think actually you'll find, if you look at President Putin in the Kremlin, I'm not doing too badly. would I regard it as a violation of my human rights to be thrown in the balloon? I'd regard it as a deeply offensive thing to do, and I do have your name and address. In fact, I have everybody's name and address. Thanks to my friend on my right. So, I think you know which way to vote. Yes, it was important. Obviously, there are some people who would claim that it wasn't just the Soviet army that defeated fascism. There are some who would point to my failure to act on the intelligence of the Nazi attack as making me somehow responsible for the destruction of the Red Army and the loss of 5 million casualties. There are some people who say that I was prepared to sacrifice Soviet soldiers by sending them into battle without guns, and therefore my contribution to the war effort was exaggerated. But all those people are dead, so I put them in the gulag when they did say it, so I'm not too worried about them either. Throwing out Marxism, well, I have to say, I don't want to throw out Marxism. It got me where I was. It was Karl Marx who denounced human rights. It was the Marxists who sought to exclude all other political traditions from the left. It was the Marxists who sought to dominate political thought to the exclusion of other points of view. I think you have to draw your own conclusions.
Right, thank you very much, Joseph. At least you can't say that Joseph is ingratiating, can you? Now we move to, I wonder if I could just ask you now, if you would just, because it's the last moment when you're going to be seeing four of them, so I wonder if I could just ask you perhaps to give just a round of applause to all of them, because some of them... Now, I knew the tension would mount. We already have cheers and catcalls. This is what I'm going to do now. I'm going to take a vote. I'm going to ask you to vote in the order of that we heard the presentations. There are tellers around the room, but I'm going to see if I can just do this visually for the moment. If it's not possible to do that, then we'll come back. And you remember what we're going to do is to look for the two highest number of votes. They will be the two people who remain in the balloon, and the other four people will be asked to hurl themselves off. I remember a Tommy Trinder joke about tossing themselves off the bridge or something. Anyway, they'll be asked to toss themselves off. So could we have votes for the first? First, this is the votes. How many people here feel that Mahatma Gandhi should be allowed to remain in the balloon? Now, can I emphasize, before you raise your hands, that I think I'm asking you, please, you're required to vote, I think, for one person only. Otherwise, it gets ridiculously complex. So you are not allowed to vote for anybody else. Those people who would keep Mahatma Gandhi in the balloon. Thank you very much. That's roughly 41. The way sociologists do statistics. What a silly joke. I'm calling that 41. Now, can we have those people who think that Martin Luther King should remain in the balloon? Can I see that? 12. Thank you very much. Now we move on. Nelson Mandela. How many people would feel Nelson Mandela should remain in the balloon? 27. Thank you very much. It's remarkable, isn't it? And George Orwell. How many for George Orwell? 18. Thank you very much. And then Eleanor Roosevelt. 25 I make that. And then finally, Joseph. Joseph.
I know them all.
Oh, what a lot of liberals are in the audience tonight. It's a liberal audience. Where else? Well, so that means to say that the two people, unless anyone wants to correct me, that the people who are going to go out of the balloon, I think we should be like Eric Morley and Mecca dancing and throw people out first of all, shouldn't we? So the first person to be ejected from the balloon, well, there are two equals here. We're talking about Martin Luther King and Joseph Stalin. Could I ask them to leave the balloon? And they're closely followed by the next two people to leave the balloon. Who am I throwing out now? I've forgotten. George Orwell I'm throwing out, aren't I? George Orwell's still here. And who's the last person to go? I've forgotten my number. George Orwell. So we're leaving, the two people being left behind are Mahatma Gandhi and Nelson Mandela.
Right,
thank you very much.
All right, I'm now going to invite Mahatma Gandhi or Mahatma Gandhi's representative on Earth and also Nelson Mandela to address us now for 3 minutes each, and then we will move to a final exciting, one can hardly wait, vote. Right, I think I will ask, as we're doing the order, would you like to speak first?
Here?
Yes. Would you go up to the
lecture?
Do you prefer the lecture?
Oh, no.
Happy there?
No. I think that I would not speak in the first person. It would be a macabre image for you, for someone of my kind, to pretend to emulate such a person. I chose the third person. He is a man who would be very sorry to leave the balloon or for others to leave it. He'd rather the ship go down with all hands on deck. I guess that would be the situation. Or he would encourage others to achieve the almost weightless condition that he seemed to seek in his in the example that he set to many others. So one might almost want him to invoke that wonderful carpet that could transport all six on this platform to the greater regions of the world in order to express themselves in words achieving a kind of consensus. He would want to seek what means of negotiation would lead to agreement on how they could live together happily ever after.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mahatma. You did inspire me in my youth, and you are a symbol to us all who care about human rights. But just think how much you'd miss me when I'm gone. How much you'd miss my tendency to break into dance at the end of interviews. Did you never see me on the first program? Or my flowery African shirt? Or my penchant for the Spice Girls? Somebody's got to have one. Or my very special smile and wonderful, wise, lined face. The world is in crisis. We need a steady hand. We need wise counsel. And we need wise counsel from someone who has struggled all their life and at the end of it, still believes that it is possible to find common ground for people to live together in harmony, including the oppressed with their oppressors, based on human rights principles. When my successor makes one or two slightly interesting comments about AIDS being a disease of poverty and not curable by antiviral drugs, I manage to say something to the effect that my son died of AIDS, and he wouldn't have died of AIDS if he'd had the right drugs in time. After September the 11th, I expressed my anguish for the thousands of innocent victims of that terrible atrocity, and I make stern and significant comments about the peril that the only superpower is holding us all in its approach to conquering the world. Without me, there would have been no living example of human rights in practice, just warm words, broken promises, partially enforced treaties, or if anything, and an ongoing important but unproven political discourse. After the Cold War almost sullied the noble idea of human rights, I almost single-handedly restored its reputation and replaced it at the heart of relations between nations at the end of the 20th century. As I said to you, I'm a humble guy. You'll miss me when I'm gone.
Well, we have just, we stop at 8 o'clock tonight. We have 3 minutes to go. And in that 3 minutes, we have a highly consequential vote to end this fascinating evening of intellectual entertainment. So I'm just going to give you a few seconds to reflect. And while you're just reflecting, I will mention that the site for the drinks afterwards is on the fifth floor and is in the senior common room. I think you're unlikely to find academics of this quality hanging around the senior common room, but all of these speakers will be up there. I've been up there, you know, I've been there. I've tried to get a conversation going. So could we just take a quick, a long and extended vote? Now you're being asked. This is very serious. Mahatma Gandhi is going to be asked to stand on the edge of this fragile gondola and hurl himself down to death. Destruction thousands of feet below, and the same applies to Nelson. Who is going to go? Who are you going to throw out? Who are you going to declare to be the human rights personality, the greatest human rights personality for modern times? I think in this case we will go in reverse order, and I will ask for those people who would wish for Nelson Mandela to remain as the sole occupant of the balloon. But I see you voting. I'm now going to ask the tellers, will they take a vote, please? No, keep your hands up, please. I'd like everyone to have a good look at you. So if we could just, the tellers, there is a, we have tellers. I'm just proclaiming that the tellers. We have tellers? Yes, we do. This is going to be quite close. Very. Thank you very much. Do you want to call out your individual totals? And
21 upstairs.
21 upstairs. 18 for the back.
23 for the middle.
Sorry, how many?
23 in the middle.
23 in the middle. And is that it? That's it. So that's 9, that's 2, that's 62. 62, very, very close. So now can we see those who are voting for Mahatma Gandhi? Right, we will take the count. It looks as though Gandhi may just have it, but I'm going to take the count because I think it's pretty close. You could keep your hands up.
I'm 35 upstairs.
35 upstairs. 14 on the back. Sorry? 30. 39, that's 79. So I'm afraid I shall have to ask Nelson Mandela to leave. Thank you all for your wonderful enthusiasm. Thank you for being here. Season's greetings. Have a great time. Free drinks upstairs, fifth floor, senior common room. See you there. Bye.